Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Your life, your country. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast.
Welcome to the Best of the Laura Ingraham Podcast. Thanks for listening. There's so many memorable guests and unforgettable moments from both radio over the years and this podcast. And I thought it'd be a great time to put some of this together so you have it at your fingertips. Conversations with my most incredibly scintillating guests, all unforgettable. Enjoy it here on the Laura Ingraham Podcast. Joining us now, delighted she's with us, Rahil Raza is the president of the Council for Muslims Facing Tomorrow, the author of the book, Their Jihad, Not My Jihad. And also she's in Washington promoting this fabulous new film, Kids Chasing Paradise, which we'll discuss in a moment. But we got such a great reaction to Rahil Raza on the Ingraham angle on Fox that I wanted to chat with her for a longer period of time about this new dynamic of these very, very vocal and, well, attention-grabbing female Muslim congresswoman in Washington, D.C., and how that might portend other more radical movements to come in the United States. Rahil, it's great to have you on the podcast. Let's talk about this. Ilhan Omar argues that she is more pro-American, loves the country more than native-born Americans. Has that been borne out in her comments and her actions?
It certainly hasn't been borne out. I would say that she's a very good liar. Since the day she was elected, she has said, nothing that would prove that she loves America. She has been critical of the President of the United States of America. And these are the people who elected her, so the hypocrisy and the double standards and the lying. And she has a history of going back and forth. You know, she says things and then she retracts. And so how can one trust what she's saying? I mean, her actions and her words have proven beyond reasonable doubt that she hates the president and she hates the country. So when he invites her to leave, then she gets upset and plays the race card.
Yeah. And what is the agenda here? I mean, they've been very transparent about decriminalizing illegal immigration, Green New Deal. Most of them support one way or another. Some type of socialized medicine. They call it Medicare for All, which will just bankrupt Medicare very quickly. But what is their ultimate goal? Is it to transform the Democrat Party, blow it up, make America part of just a general global order so we shake the bonds of or the connection to the evil racist past? I mean, what do you see happening here?
You know, it's very complicated, but what I see is this push towards globalism and Islamism. And when I say Islamism, I'm talking about political Islam, which is an agenda of the Muslim Brotherhood. And the, you know, globalism is also something that they are pushing for. And it's very insidious. It's very dangerous. And they keep, Ilhan Omar keeps deflecting from the real issues of what she's talking about by constantly blaming someone else for what is happening. But I think that the Democratic Party needs to be very cognizant of the fact that this is a dangerous agenda. And in the work that I do with youth radicalization, I believe she is setting a very, very dangerous precedent for young people that it's okay to hate America, it's okay to hate the president, it's okay to insult him and abuse him. And not to mention that she has normalized anti-Semitism to a degree where it has become an everyday occurrence. I clearly remember working in the field of trying to, expose the dangers of anti-Semitism the 20 years ago. It was still something of a shock to hear anti-Semitic remarks. That is no longer the case. It has become normalized by everyone. And everyone has jumped on the bandwagon because you have people in power, a congresswoman who holds responsibility. And if she can be anti-Semitic, so people feel that it's normal to do so.
Well, and they write it off as, oh, you're just, every time they're criticized, they say you're Islamophobic or racist or xenophobic. That's just their reflexive response, is it not, Rahil?
That is. It is this whole issue of Islamophobia, which is a term that is used to shut up any kind of criticism, to actually stifle free speech. And it is, again, a very dangerous tool that is used by the Islamists to stop us from criticizing and speaking out. So anyone who criticizes what any of these four women say will be called an Islamophobe, a racist, a bigot, because they're playing identity politics. And that is something that they shouldn't be doing, because in the world today, we already have the danger of this kind of rhetoric leading to hate, leading to radicalization, and then ultimately leading to violence. This documentary that we are showing, in that we show what is it that ultimately leads to violence. It's hate.
And we're talking to Rahil Reza, who's the author of the book, Their Jihad, Not My Jihad, and also is promoting this incredible film, Kids Chasing Paradise. Tell us about the film, why this is so important, and what we need to understand about the, again, tolerating political Islam in the United States, tolerating it, normalizing it, making ourselves numb to it, and how that could lead ultimately to really, really bad results.
This is a documentary that takes an unflinching look at the brutal exploitation of youth by extremists worldwide. And the reason this is important is because, according to the George W. Program on Extremism, investigations of connections with ISIS have been opened in all 50 states. There are 1,000 open investigations with 182 arrests having already been made, and 45% of the arrests are of people under 30. So we know from UN statistics that there are child soldiers fighting in the world. We know that ISIS has recruited thousands of young people, including Americans, Canadians, Europeans. And this radicalization of young people is an issue that has spilled over into the West. It is just not being addressed. So we are showing this film, and accompanying this film, we have a workshop called PVE, which is Preventing Violent Extremism. And in this workshop, we talk about the factors that lead to youth radicalization and how we can prevent it before it happens.
And Rahil, I'm talking to a lot of friends in Europe who tend to be fairly liberal on social issues and so forth, and they didn't really care for Donald Trump for a whole bunch of reasons, and Swedish friends and friends in Norway. And I've got to say, my one Swedish friend who, she and I argue politely on text messages a lot about Trump, but she has seen her country transformed in many places, in many ways, by the misogynistic and oftentimes violent aspects of this radical view of Islam brought in by refugees, mostly from Syria, into Sweden. And the crime, the liberal leaders of Sweden making excuses, saying you can't publish people's ethnicity on Facebook who are perpetrators of horrible acts of violence against women. And now the Swedes are fed up. They're just fed up with this, but I'm wondering if it's just too late now for them. But they're starting to deport a lot of these people who are radicalized and spreading radicalization in throughout Sweden.
Well, I'm afraid it's too late for Sweden and for the rest of Europe, and in some ways for the UK. Now, I've been on educational tours to all these countries, and Sweden was the most concerning. It was a terrible state of affairs. There is a town in Sweden called Malmo where the police would rather resign than go in and do law enforcement because it is so dangerous. The Islamists have totally taken over. And I asked members of parliament in Sweden that you have such a wonderful country and so many resources and such great infrastructure, and why are you letting this happen? And I will never forget what they said. They said, we have too much. We have too good a thing, and we want to share it. Well, the sharing has led to this situation where it's too late for them to turn back. They wanted to bring in ISIS fighters and accommodate them there, take the immigrants and the refugees that they have accepted into parts of the country where the Swedes have never seen a colored person before, and take over their hotels and their seniors' homes. So it has been a very, very traumatic situation. Then you look at the rape gangs in the UK. They were not mentioned in newspapers, and law enforcement wouldn't do anything because they happened to be of a certain ethnic minority. They were Pakistani Muslims. And I am a Pakistani Muslim, and I can say that this was an atrocious thing that happened. But political correctness, the regressive left, the world we are living in today, and this label of Islamophobia has created an atmosphere in which people are terrified to speak out. So it becomes incumbent on Muslims like myself to be the frontline speakers and to talk about these issues, because we have to expose these problems. And if people like Ilhan Omar are not addressing problems within the Somali community, where female genital mutilation is rampant, where forced and underage marriage is happening, where young Somali boys are being recruited by Al-Shabaab, which is a terrorist extremist organization in Somalia. And I have met the Somali activists who have said, we have this problem. What can we do about it? She is so concerned about constantly abusing Trump, the United States, and of course Israel, that she doesn't look at her own community.
No, it's, and what's happened in to religious freedom. I'm reading about this patriarch of the Chaldean Catholic Church in Iraq, Louis Sacco. He's very worried about the Christians in Iraq. I mean, they've been just obviously pummeled, so many killed, and others just left after the U.S. Invasion in Iraq. They had 2 million Christians in Iraq, living peacefully, I might add, under Saddam Hussein, who kind of left them alone for the most part. But they've been decimated by the sectarian violence, driven out of their homelands.
Not just in Iraq, but in many parts of
Syria,
the world.
Syria?
Yes. They are the worst persecuted community. So let me ask you a question. The Squad, who calls themselves social justice warriors and are so concerned about the vulnerable, do they ever speak about the persecution of Christians in Muslim lands? Do they ever speak about the persecution of minorities? They don't. So where is their sense of social justice if they're only talking about one particular issue and one person, and they're not really looking at these larger issues of minority persecution, of religious persecution? I mean, social justice needs to be across the board. It can't be just for one person or against one person. So it's very transparent if the Democrats could only see through the facade and understand what the agenda is, and also a very dangerous trajectory.
Rahil Raza, thank you so much for joining us. These issues are not going away anytime soon, but we pray every day for our persecuted Christian brothers and sisters around the globe, in Jordan, in Syria, in Iraq, from the Nineveh Plains to the horrible conditions in some of these refugee camps, where Christians still are persecuted, and some now living in Europe who feel persecuted. They say home is where the heart is, and the reality is that home is where all of your precious belongings are located. Home is your sanctuary after a hard day's work. Home is a special place where you create memories with your family and your friends. So when you want to protect yourself and your most precious investment, go with the nation's number one smart home security provider, ADT. With ADT Smart Home Security, you'll have a team of professionals monitoring your home 24/7 using the latest innovations to safeguard your property. Visit ADT.com. That's ADT.com. This is the best of the Laura Ingraham podcast.
All parents know as kids get serious about their sport, hours of practice increase significantly.
They don't get a break from football. It starts right after, as soon as summer starts, they start practice, and they do a lot of weightlifting, and Then they start their two-a-days.
The trend isn't that it's too much sports, it's that it's too much of the same sport.
Medical Director of Sports Medicine for Dayton Children's Hospital, Dr. Laura Scott, says growing evidence shows that playing the same sport year-round can take your child out of the game altogether.
They might play multiple soccer teams year-round or multiple baseball teams year-round, and this creates a different sort of injury than the kids that move from season to season.
Wow. I've talked about this issue over the years, and I think even wrote about it in one of my books, of the I Zing, which is this parental obsession with sports specialization as the golden ticket into colleges. You know, a lot of this is the parents. The parents are kind of living their own vicarious fantasy, or they think everybody else is doing it, so I've got to do it. And I never got into this. I mean, I dabbled a little bit in with my kids in some of these, you know, sports and a little thing here or there, but I found the kids weren't happy. Well, my daughter plays lacrosse, and she's a pretty good lacrosse player. But I don't even think she wants to play it year-round. She likes doing volleyball in the winter. She likes playing basketball. And I said, Maria, that's what I did. I played field hockey, basketball, and softball. Yes, I was class athlete of 430 kids in my class, okay? So, yeah, I was a serious – I only say that because I was a serious athlete. But I played three sports. And we didn't have any money. My mother didn't sign up any special lessons. But I loved it. And it really helped me in my life, helped me in everything I've done to this day.
Kevin Allen's daughter, Natalie, has been playing tennis since she was six.
The older she gets, the more you like to stay specialized and try to see how far you can go. So that's our philosophy, is getting better in the sport as opposed to the jack of all trades.
But experts caution doing the same motions over and over can cause wear and tear on the tissues and joints. Across the nation, orthopedic surgeons are seeing more career-ending injuries.
Doing pretty major surgeries in younger and younger athletes. Such as ulnar collateral ligament tears or Tommy John surgeries and ACL tears.
Joining us now to talk about this and so much more, Anne-Marie Anderson and Holly McPeak. Both are the co-hosts of Sports Like a Boss podcast on Podcast One. Both, of course, phenomenal athletes in their own right. Over the course of her career, Anne-Marie covered six Olympic Games, NBA playoffs, Super Bowl, golf majors, done so many incredible shots and features for ESPN, NBA Today, and SportsCenter. Holly is a three-time beach volleyball Olympian for the United States. How cool is that? Of course, 2004 games in Athens, they got the bronze medal there. And she was the first woman worldwide to surpass $1 million in career earnings in 2002, and she retired in 2009. This is amazing. Both of them incredible, incredibly inspiring people. And I cannot wait to talk about something that's not political. Anne-Marie and Holly, how you doing, girl?
Thanks
We're
for having us. We're
great.
Excited.
You're right up our alley, boy. It's a vortex.
Now, it's a little hard to have two guests on a podcast, as I don't have to tell you guys this. So I'm going to address each of you separately so we can hear what both of you are saying, because you both have such great I love your podcast, number one, and I just love your voice on this. Holly, let's start with you, because to get to the level where you were as a volleyball player, like moms would say, or dads who are very competitive would say, well, you have to be that focused. You have to do it year-round. You have to. Well, how would you answer that with this concern about the specialization obsession?
Well, actually, I didn't specialize at an early age. I played soccer, I played beach volleyball, and I played indoor volleyball. And you think volleyball, same sports, but beach and indoor are very different, moving in the sand, giving your body a break. So I played three sports all the way through to my junior year in high school. And I think it really gave my body a break. I looked forward to another season. And now we're hearing from college coaches when we talk to them that they really treasure multi-sport athletes. Athletes who are specializing too early are coming into college with injuries. They're injured before they even step on the court. And it's really scary. Too much, they never get a break. We used to have the whole summer off, and I couldn't wait for summer to do anything different than what I do all year long, which are those sports. As much as I love them, it's nice for your body and your brain to have a break.
Yeah, and I got to say, Anne-Marie, when I talk to my kids a lot about this, I have a 14-year-old daughter who's going into eighth grade, and then I have an 11-year-old boy and a 9-year-old boy, and they're all, you know, like all kids, they're all different. And I talk to them a lot about this, but when the fall, when that first, you know, crisp feeling of fall comes, I still remember the feeling of hitting the field hockey ball. I still remember that feeling of the smell of the bag, the feeling in spring of the first crack of the bat in softball. I mean, every sport brought me something different. Basketball was my least favorite, but I still, that was fun too because it was freezing in Connecticut and it was fun to play basketball. But just that differentiation, as cliche as that sounds, brings you a whole different set of experiences and I think activates your brain and your body in such positive and powerful ways versus the constant repetitive stress of the same thing over and over and over. Or am I just exaggerating it and I'm trying to make this be like, oh, the good old days were better than today's days, like all old fogies do?
No, I get it. I mean, I have the same setup that you do, a 14-year-old, an 11-year-old, and a 7-year-old. Part of the problem, though, Laura, isn't just the parents with wanting this. It's the coaches demanding year-round now or trying to. But I'm with you. If you miss it, then you tend to love it. And so if you take a few months off, go do something else, use some different muscles, then you can pitch. You said basketball wasn't your favorite. You wouldn't have known that if you hadn't played the other sports. And I think it's important to dip your toe in each sport. Some of it is the parents, yes, but some of it is the coaches saying, we want, they get money from when you're at the tournament. They get money from the extra coaching. And so as parents, I think we need to pull back on that and say, no, you may not have my child all year round. I think it falls on the parents to say, you may not. And as you point out, sometimes the parents are taken because this is the ticket. This is the ticket to college, and it isn't.
Holly, this is actually, you know, it's kind of obvious, I guess, but we forget that this has become a huge business. So the lacrosse camps, just focusing on the explosion of youth lacrosse, that is big, big money. And I think to Anne Marie's point, there are a lot of coaches and, you know, entrepreneurs who are giving parents a false sense of what his or her child's talents are. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you're going to devote this much time, like year round, and spend thousands of dollars, sometimes you don't have it, but you're spending it because you think you have to. But your kid, you know, some kids are going to be great athletes because they have the genetic material and they have the drive and they have that thing. But some kids just aren't. The period.
Yes.
But they're sold a bill of goods because it's huge, huge money.
Well, it's interesting because I own a beach volleyball club and people come to us with the hope of us preparing them or training them to get to the level where they're able to compete in college. And we don't guarantee it. We say, hey, we're the best coaches. We can prepare you in the best way, but there's no guarantees. We can expose you to all these different coaches. It's the dream of the athletes and the coaches, and the parents wanting this for, you know, it's hard to get into college. So anything extra on your resume that can help get you in that door, even if you're a walk-on athlete. I mean, we saw the big college admission scandal. I mean, they were using sports in the wrong way because they didn't even compete in that sport. But there's athletes who can walk on and compete and really contribute to college teams. So if you're playing and you're training and preparing at a high level, you can have opportunities, but not everybody can. And, you know, it's tough. We don't guarantee it. We say we're going to do the best we can to get you there, but we do not, promise anything.
Yeah, it's funny when I was listening to some parents, this was must have been 4 or 5 years ago now, at one of these little lacrosse clubs in D.C., Washington, D.C. And my kids I just wanted my kids to have somewhere to go in the cold weather months, like to throw a ball around and goof around because I have two boys and one of them is a real ruffian and he's really funny. So I wanted him to do something. But I literally heard mothers who were mothers of 6 and 7-year-olds talking about Duke's lacrosse program and how she heard that if you do this and this and this. And I just stopped them. I couldn't resist. I stopped and I said, how old are your kids? She said, oh, you know, Trevor is 8 and I have another son who's 9 and you know we train at the University of Maryland. I'm like, what? I'm sorry, but I'm like, okay, I played in college 2 sports. I wasn't an Olympian, but I was pretty good. I was like, this is just madness. This is complete and utter madness. And the kids all look exhausted, by the way. They just look exhausted all the time.
It's funny that you say that because we talked to Tony Azevedo this week. He's a 5-time Olympic water polo player.
Oh, phenomenal.
He talks about the parents really putting a focus on, hey, we got to win the U10, the under 10 age group for water polo. It's like, you don't have to win that. And we have the same problems with beach volleyball, indoor volleyball. They feel like they want that trophy. They need that title, the U10 or U12 champ. When they're not even focusing on getting better with their skills, they just want to compete every weekend. And we, Tony as a coach and myself, have that battle all the time. I said, you guys don't need to play every weekend. You don't need to do that. You need to get better because it's going to catch up to you and then you're going to regret it.
And you know what, Anne-Marie, when I was getting ready for the show today, I thought to myself, if I had every dollar back that I had spent on all the things I had spent, like hockey. Like, I have 2 Russian sons, right? So I thought, well, hockey, they it's about genetic. They just wake up and they just want to skate, right? I took them over to the Caps hockey rink because they have this Caps practice rink in Northern Virginia. The kids were like, can we go out, you know, use our little remote control boat in the pool? Because we like doing that. Like, we don't want to do this. It's so fun. I'm thinking that the equipment, it is just. But it kind of, you feel, I look back on some of those decisions I made. It's not the end of the world. It's not a big deal. But, like, there are a lot of people who can't afford it and who feel like if you're not doing it, you're a bad parent.
Yeah. And it isn't helping the kids because, as you said, as soon as the game's over, they want to go get ice cream. I mean, it's putting the money into it is not necessary. And putting your hopes on your child playing well. I mean, one of the things we see a lot and we talk about a lot is how the parents are so invested in every stroke of the child's athleticism. And if the child makes a mistake, you can see the parent defeated in the stands. And if the child does a great thing, you can see the parent's chest puffed out. The kid doesn't care. The kid just wants to play and then go get ice cream. And so the money that the parents are putting in is for what? You're not getting that money back. And I'm right with you. I'm just as guilty as everybody else. All my kids play a ton of sports. I have to talk myself off a ledge half the time about, no, he does not have to be in this tournament. And when I don't register my kids for that tournament, I get a note from the coach half the time saying, hey, how come your kid isn't going to this tournament? And I say, well, we're going to the beach. We're taking
a day
off.
You know what I say? This is like Sundays. I say, sorry, we're actually going to be in Mass on Sunday morning. Cause like when I grew up, like I was not super religious or anything and I'm not like a holy roller or anything, but we go to Mass on Sunday. Like we can't miss Mass. That's just our thing. Like we go to Mass, like we're not going to like travel to Roanoke, Virginia to play 11-year-old soccer. I'm just not going to do that.
Yeah.
It takes away from family time. It takes away from, I think the stress is not lessened by this travel. I want to just bring this up to our listeners as well and get you both to comment on this. There's a piece that came out in Forbes, you might have seen it in April, about the money that parents spend to try to get their kids a scholarship into a university. And it's interesting that 40% of the 1,000 families surveyed figured that their child could get a scholarship on athletics. 34% said their child could go pro or even make it to the Olympics. The actual rate of high school athletes who receive a college scholarship of any kind, even a partial one, 2%. And of course, Holly can speak to how many people make the Olympics, like 0.00005%. But that's just a perception deal. Holly, you can chime in on that.
Yeah, well, it's crazy. I mean, I remember youth sports and my two older stepsons when they were playing, and their kids on their team at, 12 thinking, oh, yeah, I can go pro. And I'm like, and they're not even playing at the youth level. I mean, they've got this pipe dream. And, obviously NBA or whatever, the Olympics, it's aspirational. So these kids grow up with role models. And they want that. But, I mean, getting there is a whole different thing. We're looking at, the negative, the too much. But there's so many great lessons that come out of sports, too. You just don't want to overdo it. I mean, teamwork, competitive, learning how to deal with a problem, figuring out a solution, interacting with, your teammates and finding a way to win together. I mean, there's so many great things, but it's just been pushed too far.
Yeah, and Anne-Marie, I say this a lot to my kids, how I, when I'm thinking about the best memories of growing up, they're simple memories, but that team spirit and the perfect pass and the time that we lost the state tournament in field hockey by one goal, like just these memories, they're such powerful memories. And I think Holly, you said it right. I think it was Holly said it. It takes away from that when you're putting so much pressure on yourself or your kids to be the best and to go to every game, tournament, match, and every professional trainer. Because my gosh, what would we do without sports? I don't know what I would do to this day without sports.
No, and what we learn from it, you take. I mean, how many times, Laura, have you not gotten the job that you want? Well,
yep.
Sometimes you lost the tournament when you were a kid. That's how you learn resilience. And that's what sports should be about. And when the parents are all clogged up in there and saying, yeah, my kid's going to get a scholarship. And believe me, I'm talking parents off the ledge every tournament I go to. And I do it with the numbers. Hey, there's only 4.5 scholarships for boys in this. It's chopped up between 12 kids, your kid, my kid, and that kid. None of us are getting scholarships. But what they are getting here is learning resilience. And I think that's lost. That's the biggest thing that we use in our lives as broadcasters and businesswomen now is when I lost, I came back, I worked on the things that I needed to, and I did better. Now I do the same thing in broadcasting. What do I need to work on so I can go get the job? That's what it's supposed to be for.
Anne-Marie, do you have any words of advice, and then I'm going to ask Holly before we close, any words of advice for the young women listening and the folks listening to this about wanting to, get into the business of broadcasting and in sports? I mean, people ask me about the political stuff all the time, and I don't know if I even have any great advice, but the sports world is super, super competitive on the broadcasting level. What did you need to bring to the table to stand out from all the other women out there who've wanted to break into the field?
So I'm in my 30th year in, I hate saying that number too, but 30th year in sports television. I know it's brutal. I need to stop.
You're so
that.
Good though. You're so talented. Oh my God. You're great. You do such a great job.
Thank you. I appreciate that. What you need to bring is a love for the dirty work, a love for listening for the right sound bite, a love to learn. I feel like, and now I'm really going to sound old, that with social media and the likes and the emphasis on what you look like, a lot of women getting into broadcasting and sports broadcasting now are focused on that. I didn't have any of that. It had to be my brain. It had to be my brain coming in. And so look at the people that you admire and ask them to mentor you. We all got helped by somebody along the way. You need to ask. But Laura, I'm sure you have the same experience. People ask for help. I offer to help and they don't follow up.
Follow up.
I am not going to chase you to help. Follow up.
Oh, that is so funny. That's or they'll send you a text. My son wants to get into the, do you have any ideas? I mean, you can't just be so glib about it. You have to be very deliberative about trying to, get help and network with people. And I think, Anne-Marie, I say, I have to be careful what I say because people take everything out of context, but I think the whole emphasis on looks, period, in sports is really, it's bad. I mean, we're saying this to Holly with the beach volleyball players who somehow are all good looking. I don't know how that is, but but they usually are really good looking. Let's just be honest about that. Okay. That's not a stereotype. That's just a fact. But especially with broadcasting, Holly, I do say that it's bad for me because maybe I'm making a generalization, but the better looking you are, you know, I think people say, oh, okay, that's how she got the job. But there are some really good looking people who are just really good at what they do. So you can't hold it against them. But I think that shouldn't be the reason in politics, sports, or anything, any company that you get hired. But, you know, I guess that is kind of the reality that we're dealing with.
Yeah, there's a focus, you know, in our culture on how people look, no matter what they do. So, you know, it's our culture, it's social media, you know, everybody's getting the attention when they look good. But for me, when I broke into broadcasting, I got an opportunity. I was a 3-time Olympic athlete. I'd won an NCAA championship. So I got the opportunity. And guess what? I was really bad. I didn't even know what I was doing. but I did the work. I did the work, and it still took me a long time. I didn't even feel that comfortable till my fifth year, because there's not that many opportunities to work on TV for volleyball. So I didn't have that many opportunities to get better, but I worked with somebody. We critiqued me on video, and it was the most painful thing, but I wanted to get better, and I'm coachable. And I think that's one of the things that I learned from sports. Being coachable is so important in life. If you want to get better, if you want to do things at the highest level, you have to be coachable. You have to be willing to do what it takes to be the best.
Have you both gone back and looked at your first or second or third runs on television? Anne-Marie,
no,
have you
and
gone
I
back?
No, I don't want to.
Absolutely. I would be crying. Painful. It is painful. We did the same thing with the podcast. I've told Holly, like, you have to listen to it. We have to get better each time. It doesn't change no matter how long you've been doing it. You got to listen back to your own work. Get better.
You do. And I always say, once I do it, I don't even want to see myself. I don't want to see myself on TV. People say, do you ever Google yourself? I say, literally, I've never Googled myself. Not one time. Not one time. Yeah. God knows what you'd find. You guys are amazing. Incredible. Just an incredible inspiration, I think, for so many folks out there, especially women, but just everyone, women, men. People who set a goal, fulfill their goal, who've succeeded across so many businesses and in sports and in broadcasting. I hope you guys will come back. And I'm so excited of the success of your podcast, Sports Like a Boss, on Podcast One. It's really, really popular. And just thanks so much for being out there.
Thank you so much
for having us.
Oh, by the way, Pluto TV is the leading free streaming television service. You watch over 100 TV channels and thousands of movies on demand, all for free. No credit card needed, no sign up. Pluto TV is the easy and completely legal way to watch your favorite TV shows and hit movies. So what are you waiting for? Never pay for TV again. Download Pluto TV for free on all of your favorite devices today. America, now and forever, you're listening to the best of the Laura Ingraham podcast. Wait a second, that sounds like Ted Nugent. Oh, no way. A new Ted Nugent album just out. The Music Made Me Do It. And we are so happy to have him on. He's the host of the new podcast, The Ted Nugent Danger Zone, with Tim Wells. And he's just one of our favorites. Singer, songwriter, guitarist extraordinaire. And his tour kicks off on July 19th in Pasadena. And I'm just so thrilled to have him on. Ted Nugent, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing so good, Laura. It's stupid. Thanks for having me on, and happy summertime rock and roll barbecue season and Independence Day every damn day to
you. You bet. I was in, I was up in northern Minnesota, and I got to tell you, Minnesota is like a throwback to the 1970s rock and roll where I grew up. Okay, 70s, 80s. It was, you know, we were listening to rock. We're listening to some ZZ Top. Got a little Ted Nugent in there. We got some, you know, we got some old, incredible, awesome Aerosmith. And I was thinking, this is the way America, remember growing up in the 70s, it's just the way it was. And it was really, it was
well,
no politics.
It still is.
A blast.
It really, Yeah, it really still is. I mean, Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley and Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis and Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters and B.B. King and Freddie King, they're all still alive in our bellies. And all that killer, authentic, soulful, American, raising hell rock and roll music is still alive and well all across this country. I'm going on tour. This will be my 62nd year. That's 62 years of rock and roll. And Laura, I'm 71 this year, and I'm having so much fun. It's literally out of body. The music still does make me do it. And real music lovers just drive us nuts. So it's going to be the greatest tour of my life in 2019. Mm. How do you figure that, huh?
No, that's, I mean, the longevity you've had in the entertainment business is absolutely stunning. I have to ask you music questions, if you don't mind, before we get into anything else.
Sure.
How are your hands after playing for all that time? Like, I have all sorts of, you know, repetitive stress from, you know, all the sports I've played. But how are your hands? How do you keep them limber, and how do you keep them moving as fast as they moved in your 20s?
Well, the name of the record is The Music Made Me Do It. The name of the tour is The Music Made Me Do It Again. I mean, I play my guitars every day.
If you
could see the grin on my face right now and three really worn-out, tired dogs at my feet, Happy,
aww,
Sadie, and Coco. I just got in from playing my guitar and testing the amps for the tour.
Oh my God.
And that's the highest of highs. I felt like a horny teenager in a garage with my first loud amp. It really is fresh. Because I live a hunting, ranching, farming, fishing, trapping, outdoor, spirit of the wild lifestyle. And the healing powers of nature is what Jimi Hendrix needed. It's what John Belushi needed. It's what Bon Scott needed. It's what all those dead rockers needed. Elvis needed the healing powers of nature. But instead they used drugs and alcohol and just, you know, really suicidal, you know, so-called peer pressure mistakes, but I get away from the music, but I can't wait to get in my barn and plug in every day when I come in from the swamp or when I fillet a few bluegills for the dinner table. The juxtaposition of the primal goo of my hunting lifestyle, my outdoor lifestyle, compared to the electric hand-to-hand combat sonic warfare of my musical dreams, they're so opposite that they really inspire each other. So my fingers are cocked, locked, and ready to rock, Doc, because I play every day. So I don't think I have any. If I ever commit a crime, I'm going to use my left hand because I don't think I have any more finger impressions. You can't take my fingerprints anymore. But
so
I keep myself in good shape. You know, I've been clean and sober for 71 years, so my focus remains pretty damn good.
Did you ever have a drink in your life?
Yeah, I had a couple beers one time. I think I had a half a beer once after a grouse hunt because it was really hot and nobody had anything else to drink. And it was delicious, by the way. And then my sons and my daughters and my brothers and sisters, when we have Thanksgiving dinner, they like a little wine. In fact, I have a little wine once in a while with some venison backstraps on the grill with Mrs. Nugent. So I'm not like I'm militantly against alcohol. I think it qualifies as a beverage in responsible quantities. But no, I've never done the drugs or alcohol or tobacco.
So
and I do chew on a cigar when I shoot my machine guns because I feel like Sergeant Rock and it just seems to be the appropriate image. But I don't think I really smoke it. I think I just chew on it.
Oh my gosh. Ted, first of all, I was thinking, I knew I was going to have you on. And so I had my kids. We were up at a friend's farm, and I was with a number of just great folks. And my kids had never shot before. And it was so great to have like 4 6-foot-5 guys who were just incredible, old family friends, just great people who are big, big hunters. I mean, they're incredibly responsible. It's all about gun safety. It's about respecting the firearm. It's about every aspect of gun safety. I think they went over it. They must have gone over it 20 times. And they quiz the kids. And my kids are 14, 11, and 9. Two boys, the youngest and the older is the girl. And the kids were curious, but they weren't clamoring to shoot. Maybe the little one, Nico, who's a total piece of work, he was clamoring to shoot. But the other ones weren't. And I finally said, come on, guys, you're in this spectacular place, total safety. We have the best, you know, people to teach you. And sure enough, my daughter gets up there. It's just a little .22 rifle. Then she was shooting a Glock. She gets up there, and it's a target about, maybe it was about 38, 40 yards. she hit every one out of 10 except two. And I was
That's
like,
because you're a good mother and you've disciplined them. Marksmanship and firearm safety. We just celebrated, Laura, our 30th year of the Ted Nugent Camp for Kids charity, where we've graduated close to 18,000 young boys and girls into being the best that you can be. You know, finding that spirit within of your American dream, clean and sober. And when these kids, and a lot of them are inner city kids, because a lot of our camp directors are law enforcement and military, and they seek out kids that need that extra bit of love and extra attention and extra discipline. Mm-hmm. But that aim small, miss small, samurai focus. And I don't care if you're fascinated by guns or you're totally disinterested. By the time you learn that breathing, sight acquisition, trigger squeeze, there is a samurai that will be manifested in our lives when you dedicate your entire being to aim small, miss small. And it works with writing. It works with guitar playing. It works with welding. But ultimately, everybody's fascinated with firearms because it represents that self-evident truth that our founding fathers wrote down, because it's about defending your sacred gift of life in its ultimate application. So, yeah, I've never met anybody, including a bunch of goofy hippies I used to hang out with, who were against guns. They wanted to ban guns until they got to the range and found that inner zen of being the path of your life, which is the projectile management of marksmanship. And it really is the highest of highs when you apply yourself to that.
And I think young people, when they learn about the safety aspects, the power of a firearm, and the beauty of hitting that target just right, that's the best thing, in a way, you can teach kids if you're going to ever expose them to guns, which, you know, it's
well, you want
it's
accountability.
Not,
you want them to learn.
Absolutely.
I wrote in my book, God, Guns, and Rock and Roll, I had a whole chapter about how I was trained to fear the punishment of mishandling a firearm by
Absolutely.
My dad. Absolutely.
And we were teaching our kids. Yep. Yep.
So that's an important training process.
But the girls are good shots, naturally. I think women have a sense of natural.
Better. The girls are always better.
My daughter was unbelievable. She turns around and I said, drop the... Drop that barrel. Put it down before you turn around to me. You know the old thing when kids turn around and they're like, no. But she is incredible. I mean, they learn fast, but you have to drill the safety into them. And you have to go over it painstakingly, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 steps. And they get it drilled in. It's like riding a bike. Then you know it, but you still have to do the pre-flight check with firearms. Is there anything in the chamber? Cock it back. Look twice. Look, is the clip out? Look to see if there's anything in the chamber. And we must have done that. I think we must have done that 50 times. Easily. 50 times.
I do it every day.
Yeah. Where do you live again, Ted? I always forget. Where do you live?
Well, I'm a Texan now because I'm addicted to freedom and Michigan.
No taxes.
I was born in Detroit. You know, Laura, Michigan was the arsenal of democracy. It was the epicenter of work ethic and pride of productivity when I was born in 48.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it's turned into a suburb of San Francisco now politically, and it just breaks my heart. California, Oregon, Washington, Michigan, Illinois, New York, New Jersey, Maryland, Massachusetts, those states don't even qualify as America anymore. It's just heartbreaking. But I'm in Michigan now in the swamps. In preparation for the tour, the dogs and Shemaine and I come up here every year to get ready to tour because we start out west and all my equipment is here. But Texan now, but I'm speaking from the soul-cleansing swamps of my sacred Michigan, which I'm fighting to keep Michigan, and I think we will persevere.
Oh, boy, we have to keep Michigan in 2020. And Ted, when you look at your career and the span of your career, do you look at periods of time, decades, and think, gosh, I was a different person then than I am now? And it's interesting I'm kind of doing that in a number of ways. And you take stock of your life, and you didn't make probably a lot of crazy, bad decisions that a lot of people make. But it's interesting with the passage of time, the changes to your way of appreciation of the things that you used to take for granted. I guess because there's less time left in your life. I find that.
Well, it's fascinating because I do a lot of interviews because I'm a strange rock and roller in that I'm hardcore anti-substance abuse. I'm hardcore pro-Second Amendment, pro-hunting, fishing, and conservation. And that doesn't fit in with the the status quo paradigm of your typical stoner rocker out there. And I got to say that a lot of the guys in rock and roll are my dear friends, and they're good people. And whether they get high or don't get high, I still love them, and I still have musical communication and family communication. But at the tender age of 71, as I'm approaching my 71st birthday, which I think is just precious, because there's nothing I do today that I really do any different than I was 20 years old or 16 years old. I still shoot my bow and arrow. I've got dogs, but now I have grandkids and kids. But I still communicate with my brothers and sisters, and I still have a rock and roll band like I did 60 years ago. So my focus is always about putting my heart and soul into being the best that I can be. That's how my mom and dad disciplined me and raised me, thank God, huh? And so I'm often able to, you know, reminisce when I do interviews with you and we talk about the past, because the past can be an indicator for your future if you've learned your lessons from the past. But I got to tell you, when I graduated from high school in 67, I had been so militantly disciplined by my mom and dad. Now, I could have gone the other way and rebelled and become a complete drooling idiot hippie, but luckily I saw really idiot drooling hippies all around me, and I saw that the drugs and alcohol turned otherwise nice, good people into drooling idiots. And so I avoided the system by which you become a drooling idiot. And I never abused my sacred temple. I've always been a hunter, so I've always eaten organic before it was hip. And I've had a damn good life. And if you see my kids, my sons and daughters, my grandkids, my brothers, my sisters, my band, my incredible wife, Shemaine, are you kidding me? I talked to my guitar player yesterday from 1964. And he said, Nugent, you haven't changed. You're still crazy. You're still out of control.
Why are those snobs in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Why didn't they put you in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? How is it possible? And you see all these people.
Because I don't believe in drugs, and I'm pro-Second Amendment, and because I murder innocent animals. You know, when I take my bow and arrow, I'm
That's
a coward
amazing.
Because I murder innocent animals.
That's
to
amazing.
Feed my family.
Yeah, and they
homeless shelter.
Yeah, and they are in favor of infanticide, but that's okay. It's save the whales, abort the babies.
Can you believe it?
Yeah, save the whales,
really
abort the babies. It's like one thing if they believed in killing nothing, but they have no problem with a million babies a year gone. That's apparently fine.
Is that so? Well, Laura, you and I have been around, but you know, there's a lot of bad and ugly, and thank you for celebrating and pounding home truth, logic, and common sense. We so look up to you for being our voice out there in the asset column of this country, who we have to be accountable. We have to be productive. We have to have a work ethic. It's in our spirit. And when Laura Ingram speaks, you speak for us, so thank you for that.
You're the best. Tell me about your band. I'm always I'm into music, always have been. So I'm always into... Who's traveling with you? How'd you meet them? Any original band members? You know, what? Tell us about that.
Well, I was born in Detroit, and my God, the musical authority that just erupted every day from every street corner in Detroit when I was born, because Bo Diddley and Chuck Berry and Little Richard had passed on what the Howlin' Wolves and the Muddy Waters and the Mose Allison and the Lightnin' Hopkins and these original black, soulful, emoting, musical gods had created. And then Motown happened, where they coalesced all this various music from gospel and blues and soul and the African aboriginal chants, you know, to the Great Spirit. That's really why I'm a hunter, I think, is because I connect with the black Africans and the Native Americans. And I bring that up because the grind of real gospel and rhythm and blues music that was manifested in its ultimate form from Motown also bled into the streets as the original drum beat from that hunter who beat on a stretched skin and twanged the bow and arrow, and that was the first guitar note. So I'm really connected to that primal scream. And when there's a Howlin' Wolf and then obviously James Brown and Motown, it impacted every band in Detroit. And I've been so blessed beyond measure from the Amboy Dukes and the Lords in 1960, and then when I was with the damn Yankees with Tommy and Jack and Michael, and today I've got Greg Smith on bass guitar for a long time, and a 23-year-old animal drummer, 23 years old, Laura, from Detroit. Mm-hmm. His name is Jason Heartless. And these guys put so much piss and vinegar and energy and attitude.
Well, how'd you find them?
Well, they found me. Because I've got the coolest songs in the world, and every killer musician wants to play my songs. Mm-hmm. And so we communicate, and we run into each other on the road and different places where we jam, and we become musical blood brothers. And these guys, I'm telling you, if I wasn't in this band, Laura, I'd go see them every night. Jason and Greg, they create breeding music. I mean, it's just a spiritual grinding that they produce every night. And they do it to my songs that I wrote, which are like my children, my musical children. And when you see guys put their heart and soul into your songs every night, every song, every gig, I'm telling you, I genuflect at the altar of thanking God every day because my music has a life of its own because of the musicians that I've been surrounded with all my life.
Yeah, and anyone who doesn't give a huge tribute every night to his band is really not, you know, it's not cool. But the greats always did. I mean, of course, the John Bonham, who probably, God rest his soul, went way too young, getting drugs, right, and all the problems.
Right, yeah.
That phenomenal drummer, but what it takes to be a good musician, Ted, versus a great musician. Tell me what the difference is. A good versus great. Some of it is genetic talent. There's no doubt about it. Some people just have a genetic, like Oscar Peterson. There'll never be another Oscar Peterson. There'll never be another Ray Charles. There's just never going to be another one. And probably never be another John Bonham. At least I haven't seen one. But tell me the difference between
doing a damn close job. Yeah.
Good and great. Tell me the difference.
Well, it's like everything in life. I've got some mechanics that work on my trucks, and I've got welders that I weld with, and I got farmers that I plant and plow and harvest with. And you can tell a dedication level. And it's the same thing with a TV host or a songwriter or a mechanic or a plumber. You see people who really love what they're doing because the work ethic involved, if you really calculate it, the compensation, even to the richest rock and rollers on the planet, guys who have, you know, $500 million, if you looked at what Sammy Hagar puts into his music, he probably got about $1.50 an hour because it never ends. You work and you struggle and you sacrifice and you experiment with new notes and new sounds and new musical adventure. And it's a consuming dedication. You know, I got to race against Bruce Jenner when he was the gold medalist god of the world, the man's man, the most athletic, supreme beast that ever lived. And when I first met Bruce Jenner, we did some off-road racing together. And just the way he attacked every endeavor, and I was already in the attack mode because I was raised in the incredible competition music zone of Detroit, where you better kick maximum ass or you're not going to make it.
Right.
And the competition was supreme. So I've witnessed these people, and the musicians in my band, Greg and Jason, they live this stuff. The name of the record is The Music Made Me Do It. You can't be this good if you want to be a rock star, because that's phony. You can't be this good because you want to be a celebrity, because that's transparent. You have to dedicate your heart and soul. And this is what we teach our kids at the Ted Nugent Camp for Kids charity. Whatever your American dream is, whatever your goal in life is, God gave you incredible powers and gifts. If you apply those powers and gifts, clean and sober, to their maximum effect, you can do anything. And the musicians that are superhuman, I got to jam with Jimi Hendrix and B.B. King. I played bass for Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley, Laura. I know what supreme animals look like, and they taught me. I wanted to be James Brown growing up, and you can imagine his work ethic. Everybody knew he was the hardest working man in show business, and those were our inspirations. And every musician I know, you just named a bunch, from Cheap Trick to Aerosmith to ZZ Top, I know these guys. These are my buddies. They're all that dedicated. They will hone their craft so that audience is absolutely gratified and intensified. And that's the dedication it takes in any endeavor, I think.
No, and I think, again, people wonder why to society, whether you were talking about how you dress on planes, Ted, and how people show up, which I've been talking about for years. Little things matter on the path to greatness. Little things. And if you dress,
yeah,
attentive to attention to detail, the way you hold the guitar, the way you then a number of minutes a day that you practice, how you take care of your instrument, how you take care of your body, whether you dress for success or dress, you know, like you should be, you know, at the beach in public.
My dad was hardcore on posture. Stand up straight. Carry yourself with dignity. And if you met my sons and daughters, and again, my band, my crew, everybody in my life, Doug, Linda, everybody in my life, the Spirit of the Wild production team, our Camp for Kids directors and their volunteers, everybody carries themselves with pride and confidence. You know, you can't get self-esteem. You have to earn and cultivate individual, rugged individual self-esteem. And that's the missing link with this liberalism and this socialism. It's literally incentivizing slovenliness and irresponsible behavior. And that's where the obesity epidemic came from. People just have been brainwashed. I call it mushy brained. We're all mushy brained when we're young. We're looking for information and knowledge. And if you're not disciplined to be the best that you can be, you'll probably end up irresponsible. You might end up in jail. You might end up dead. But you see a lot of these manifestations of a cultural abandonment in our society with the self-inflicted, the horrors of health dilemmas. They're all choices. What are the medical profession has said over and over again that 96 to 98% of health problems in America are a direct result of stupid choices. What kind of nasty food and what kind of nasty quantities and the smoking and the drinking and the drugs and comfortably numb. I don't recognize that. That's some foreign, irresponsible goofball as far as I'm concerned. Ted, and I don't have any irresponsible goofballs in my life.
Yeah, we're talking to Ted Nugent here on the Laura Ingraham podcast, and he's kicking off his new tour on July 19th in Pasadena, and his new album, The Music Made Me Do It Again, that's the name of his tour as well. Ted, a good friend of mine who knows literally everything about rock and roll that I can think of, like every fact, every band member, every song. You know, we're listening to the radio, and some pop song comes on. It's like, you know, totally computerized and auto-tuned, and he... Look. And I say rock and roll is so dead. It's dead. Is that accurate? And if not, what bands are great rock and roll bands that are of, you know, the more recent vintage?
Well, you know, it's not dead, but it's dead in many people's lives. It's not dead in real music lovers' life. We have Greta Van Fleet out of Grand Rapids, Michigan here. Another perfect example that spirit of musical creativity and adventure.
She's not going to fill a stadium, Ted. Ted, if she's not going, who's going to fill a stadium? A rock and roll band today?
Well, real rock and rollers like me and Aerosmith and ZZ Top and
not from the 1970s. Not from the 1970s. Someone who was born after 1990 or after 1990. Where is it?
Yeah, you're right. Now the Foo Fighters are not really a new band, but
they're a 1990s band. Yeah, they were at their heyday in the 1990s.
Right.
There's
you're
nobody.
Right.
I'm saying there's nobody. There's nobody.
You know, again, the left, the agenda of the liberals and the socialists, they control Hollywood, academia, so much of the media, and unfortunately so much of our government. When you have that leftist socialism, don't be the best that you can be. You should try to get away with being as worthless as you can be, and we'll still send you a guaranteed income. I mean, some of the things out of the liberals' mouth, it's like spiritual murder. They're murdering the spirit of people. And when you murder the spirit, the first thing that's going to die is art, because you're not incentivized to make all the sacrifices to create this great music. You're not going to stay in the house and practice your ass off if there's not a paycheck at the end of the day, even though I did it before there was a paycheck. But you've got to be driven by the music. And when you do excellent work, whether you're an excellent orchard operator or an excellent mechanic, you don't have to do it for the compensation. You do it for the craft, and the compensation will come. It's called capitalism. Are you kidding me? So you're right, Laura. When you hear some of this new country music, I mean, it's like the Monkees.
Awful.
It's even though the Monkees
awful.
Were a better band
no,
than
Monkees
a lot of these
much
country
better.
Guys. And
yeah, Monkees
it's,
are much
it's
better.
Formula. It's all formula. It's the same songwriters, the same goofy lyrics. And here's the horror of horrors. In the best country music, and I got a lot of friends, Blake Shelton's a good friend, and Toby Keith has some killer musicians and creative artists out there. But when you hear the mix, where's the damn guitar solo? That's the crescendo. That's the peak of the sexuality of the song. And if there is a guitar solo, and there's some great guitarists out there, it's not even up in the mix like Billy Gibbons or Eddie Van Halen's or my guitar solo, because they don't care about it anymore. It breaks my heart.
And Ted, I have to ask you about the U.S. Women's World Cup champion women's team, Megan Rapinoe, who's been all over the place. She's incredible athletic talent. She and Trump obviously aren't buddies. She was on with Anderson Cooper last night, and she said this.
The moments kneeling were difficult for you.
Yeah, it was.
Because of people's reaction?
A little bit, yeah. But it also, it was difficult and heavy, but I had this immense sense of pride and responsibility in doing that. So I think that's where the strength of doing it a number of times came from.
So it's hard to kneel for the national anthem, and she felt an enormous sense of pride. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, Laura, like you and everybody in the asset column, and she is in the asset column. I mean, what dedication to supreme athleticism. A big salute to all those amazing athletes.
That's a given. We've all congratulated them, and that's amazing. But now
we're on to kneeling for the anthem,
and you know, being proud of it, and that's hard. And
well, where does the lie start that this president is a racist or a bigot, or he doesn't like gays or lesbians? Where does this come from? I know President Trump. People say I'm a racist. I'm anything but a racist. People who call me a racist are the racists. And if you're gay or lesbian or you're confused about your gender, I don't know anybody who cares. We want you to be happy. We want you to be able to make your own choices in life. But where does this lie that this tidal wave of bigotry and hate comes from the right? I've been in this world for 71 years this year. I've never met a racist. I knew the Klan existed, and I knew people were against, you know, freedom, and I know there's Nazis and goofballs all over the world, but when you prioritize your quality of life and you always judge based on content of character, racists won't come near you. Bigots won't enter your life. Where does she get the lie? Where does the left get the lie that President Trump wants to make America white again? Nancy Pelosi, what kind of mind-altering chemicals are you on to think such a nasty, false, hateful thing about a great president who I happen to believe is the greatest president, and he really is making America America again? So I'm confused, like everybody who lives truth, logic, and common sense. Why the hate?
Well,
and not only that, but reference to their hate, it's unsubstantiated.
Well,
it's all a lie.
It's more simply put than that, and I would say they don't really believe what they're saying. They don't really believe Donald Trump supports Nazis. It's just on its face ludicrous. What they know is that they can't argue this economy, so they have to make sure African Americans don't turn out for Donald Trump in any number, because if they do, then they're going to lose. So they have to say he's racist. Everyone who supports him is racist. He's a bad person. If you vote for him, you're a bad person. And hence, Megan Rapinoe is just another conduit through which that message is publicized. Let's listen.
What is your message to the president?
I think that I would say that your message is excluding people. You're excluding me. You're excluding people that look like me. You're excluding people of color. You're excluding, you know, Americans that that maybe support you.
I don't even know.
Hey, Megan, write this down. The president doesn't exclude anyone, period.
Well, the economy is working better for minority women business owners, African-American and Hispanic, than it's ever worked. Most of the jobs, half of the jobs created for minorities.
What level of effort is necessary to continue to lie to yourself about this president, about Republicans, about conservatives, about the NRA? I mean, to what level of effort do you have to go to lie to yourself to make up these nasty, hateful lies about all the best people in the world? I've been a life member of the NRA for my entire adult life. I'm on the board of directors with some of the highest votes. The NRA is a civil rights organization making sure that all free people have the right to defend themselves. How could you possibly hate that?
And Ted, before we let you go, what is going on with the NRA? I'm very worried about all the stuff that I'm hearing about.
Well, it's an important time because the freedom-hating media, they hate the NRA as much as they hate me. I couldn't be more proud that nasty, negative, hateful people hate me. They hate guns. They want to blame guns for crimes. All the statistics blow that argument completely out of the water, so they can't take on a debate with someone like me or Wayne LaPierre or Chris Cox or any of my fellow NRA members. So they just got to take advantage of the hateful media and academia and Hollywood and continually spreading their hate. But bottom line is the NRA is strong. It's a mom-and-pop family civil rights organization that believes in self-defense. We are online with our budget. All the allegations about misspending and inappropriate behavior are absolute lies. The board of directors is dedicated to total transparency and accountability. We will make sure that the world knows that the NRA is about the right to keep and bear arms. That is a self-evident truth written down by our founding fathers, an individual right from God, and we will fight tooth and nail to make sure it is not infringed. That's what the NRA is, and I couldn't be more proud to be a part of it.
Well, Ted Nugent, we're just so happy to have talked to you today, and so happy about the launch of your tour, your album. And remember, everyone needs to listen also to Ted's podcast, Ted Nugent, Danger Zone with Tim Wells. It's fantastic. The music made me do it again. The album and the tour kicks off July 19th in Pasadena. And find more information about where Ted's going to be on his website, which we'll link up on lauraingram.com and our Facebook page. Ted, you stay safe out there, my friend. Rock and roll. Can't wait to see you. So we'll hopefully catch you when you're on the East Coast.
Thank you, Laura. Godspeed. Have the greatest summer of your life. Aim small, miss small. Thank you for all that you do on behalf of the great families of this country.
God bless. Ted Nugent here on the Laura Ingram Podcast. I hope you're enjoying this. Oh, the Laura Ingram Podcast. This is the best of. And thank you for listening. We love your feedback. Always love your opinions. Want to hear from you. So you can email the show at ingram.podcast@gmail.com. That's ingram.podcast@gmail.com.